Different ones.
Okay, so we'll end with thank yous at the end. I want to start. Everybody have the sheets coming around?
Yeah.
Okay, there should be the single sheets and then the double sheets. So today we're going to tackle one of the most difficult, and you have to really steel yourself to tackle a topic like this. And as I was reading, sometimes you just have to close the page. Our topic today is the Sonder Commando, the special units. And maybe the first place to start as we think about this through a religious lens is that when Moshe Rabbeinu, our great teacher, when Moshe arrived at the burning bush, he was told, the Torah says in Hebrew, Shal na'alecha me'al raglecha, remove the shoes that are on your feet. Ki hamakom asher ata omed sham ad maskodeshu, because the place that you're standing on is holy ground. So you should remove your shoes. Now, first of all, the image of the burning bush is not lost on me, but the removal of the shoes is a very special significance. It appears again in the book of Yehoshua, where he is also told, Shal na'alcha, remove your shoe. There's a difference between the two shoes and the one shoe, but the idea of removing your shoes, because this is hallowed and sacred ground. So what happens when a person wears shoes? And think about this. In this room, many of you have probably noted this in your tours. Germans wore, what did they wear?
Boots.
There's a very strong association with the jack boots that the Germans wore. And what? What goes with that? What's the affect of heavy shoes, of boots?
Power,
fear, and cruelty. Insensitivity. If you wear shoes and they have soles, let's say one shoe, okay, na'alcha. This shoe has a thick sole. It's very good for walking. When I walk with this shoe on gravel or on grass, I don't feel anything. Right? The symbol of the boots, the thick boots, that is a symbol of callousness, of cruelty. You know, you have so many images of Jews being kicked, right? That feeling, that affect, is what you get when you think about boots. So Moses is told, you're going to be the leader of this people. You're going to experience what they experience. You're going to feel all the little bumps. You're going to feel all the little rocks. Everything is something that you have to feel. You have to be somebody who is sensitive. So you take off your shoes.
Is that the one that says chlotz na'alecha?
That's a different one. That's also an interesting parallel, potentially. Cecilia's pointing out that there is another. Shoes have an interesting history in the Torah and in rabbinic literature. Today we're not talking all about shoes, but once you said it, I'll just point out two things. There is a rabbinic tradition that Joseph was sold by his brothers for shoes. Ve'evyon, the Navi says, Ve'evyon a pauper ba'avor na'alayim. So the Medrash says that was Yosef. Why is Yosef and shoes, again, the same kind of thing? There's a callousness that's being described with selling the brothers selling Yosef. In a very unusual circumstance, but it comes up every couple of years, there's the halachic process, and that's what you're alluding to, called, Cecilia, called chalitza. Lachalot means to remove. So if you have a circumstance where there is a couple, and the couple have no children, and the husband predeceases the wife, so traditionally in the time of Chumash, so the brother of the husband would marry his sister-in-law. This is referred to in halacha in Hebrew as yibum, right? But what if the husband decides he's not going to, the proposed husband, the new husband, is not going to marry this woman? So there is the shoe removal. Again, there's this common image about the shoe. So my point is, by way of introduction, is that this is a topic where the fire is burning so hot that when you tread here, you have to tread very lightly, and it's difficult to put into words what's happening here. And we're going to focus on three different books that we'll reference. You have the title pages in front of you. The first book is called The Scrolls of Auschwitz. That's on the packet. The author of this book is Bear Mark. Now, Bear Mark was an Eastern European scholar who survived the war in Siberia, in Russia. After the war, he made it his life work to study the impact of the Holocaust, and he published several things. This book is incredible. We'll talk about it in depth in a minute, what it is. The book was finished by his wife, Esther Mark. It's a very powerful work. She describes how to his dying day, he was blind and bedridden, but he would not stop working on this book. And then she concluded the work. She published it after he died. This is a work that was published many years ago. I think probably in the 60s. I forget. The next book on the bottom is a newer book called Matters of Testimony by Nicholas Chair and Dominic Williams, who are two scholars who are revisiting these scrolls of Auschwitz that Mark Baer published. And then the third book is the book that you see in the left handout, We Wept Without Tears, which is a book from Gidon Greif. Who is Gidon Greif? A very prominent Yad Vashem Holocaust researcher. Gidon Greif has published several works. This is a really remarkable book because it's a collection of interviews that he did with a group of Sonderkommando over the course of many years. So the style of this kind of work is different than others. So for example, we have a lot of oral testimonies, and there's a lot of controversy about oral testimonies and what is history and what is memory, and how do you assess oral histories from years later. But one of the challenges sometimes of oral histories later on is it's very different to sit someone down in their living room or in their dining room and look at them in the eye and say, tell me everything in an hour, versus the conversations that can go on over time. So Gidon Greif, these were not just one-shot interviews. These were meetings that took place over years of how he got to know these people and how he built trust with them and how they really opened up to him. And it's a remarkable, incredible, incredible book. All of these books are very painful.
I just have a question. So he's obviously interviewing the Eisen group that are...
He's interviewing the Sonderkommando members. We'll talk about what that means exactly in a minute. But these are the three books that we're going to work with. They're very intense. Sometimes over the past years, we've talked about topics. As you notice, we have a special guest who, as I was driving here, they called me from school to say she wasn't feeling well. So there were some topics that we could talk about where you could have a 7-year-old girl coloring on the side. This is not one of those topics. You're literally talking about the ashes. You're talking about the dying. And what you see here being described is very, very painful. So these are the books that we're going to reference. And as they say in Gemara, Idach Gzil Gemor. The rest, you'll be able to learn it and read it on your own. So let's get to the focus of our topic in terms of the substance. So the Sonderkommando, which literally means the special unit, their job, we're going to focus right now on the Sonderkommando in Auschwitz. Of course, there were other death camps, as you all know, and have given tours and explained. Their job was focused directly on the immediate process of killing. And that meant before the Jews, primarily, of course, Jews, were over 1 million, although recently I read a work where they were trying to calculate that potentially there were more than previously estimated, but let's say there's 1+ million Jews who were murdered in Auschwitz. Well, the Jews that were murdered there were primarily murdered in the gas chambers. Well, someone had to lead them into the gas chambers, and direct them to undress and take away the valuables. And then after, so it means extracting the bodies, putting them on these elevators that took them up, and then putting them into the crematoria, into the ovens. That was the job of the Sonder Commando. These were men who were specially chosen because it was, obviously you could see it's a grueling physical labor to be lifting and putting in the ovens. They were often on 12-hour shifts, whereas in other places in Birkenau, they had Sundays off. They had, you know, they had some kind of
testing,
like a rest type of thing. But in the crematoria, they never had days off. It was, if there was quote-unquote work, they had work. And if they didn't, they didn't. And the most, obviously the most intense part of this is taking people and burning them. And they had to take straps, and it'll, excuse me for maybe just 1 minute, then we'll try to stay away. You know, they had to take straps and drag the bodies out, and they describe what they looked like, and how that some of these people were people that they knew, or people who were relatives of theirs. The overwhelming majority were other Jews from all kinds, you know, over a dozen nationalities who were brought to Auschwitz over the period of several years. And the people who didn't fit in the crematoria didn't fit, so they had to have special burning pits outside. So they would layer bodies and then wood, and then they would burn them outside. Yeah?
I read that they didn't do the jobs for, they could only do it X amount of time before it got through
them. So we'll talk about that in a second. The Germans, over time, would liquidate groups of Sonderkommando. At the end of the war, interestingly, the Germans tried to find all of them. Why do you think the Germans were looking for the Sonderkommando before they dismantled Auschwitz?
Kill them.
That's right.
They got their orders.
That's right. So they saw and they knew everything. So because there was some chaos in January as the Russians were approaching, one of the Sonderkommando was interviewed by Gino Greif, describes exactly what happened. He says they were all mixed together and the Germans were looking. They were saying, anybody here from the Sonderkommando? No one said anything. Several of them went on a death march. This particular one was supposed to go to Mauthausen, I think. And then he jumped off the line and ran away and didn't get shot, and he survived. So there were people who survived even several years as Sonderkommando. There were some who either committed suicide. There was a whole group in this volume. We've talked about this book before. This one, the published by Yad Vashem. This is called Years Wherein We Have Seen Evil, where it's focused on religious life in the Holocaust. There's not so much religious, so we're going to talk about it together. In this section, in the section of the Sonderkommando, not so much, but they actually, in terms of religious life, they have one group of people. They came from, I'll tell you the name of the island, Corfu.
Greece.
Yes, which several of the Sonderkommando who were interviewed by Greif and others were Greek because they were taken there late. Exactly. So they document here that there were 400 Jews from Corfu who were put into the Sonderkommando of Birkenau in July of 1944, and they refused, and they were sent to the gas chambers. So this question of how did they handle it and how did they feel about it is one of great complexity. There is a huge moral dilemma that these men faced during and after. One of the things that Gideon Greif talks about is the guilt that some of these people felt, because they felt that they were literally the accessories to the murders. And on the other hand, as many of them point out, what choice did they have? You know, what would they have done otherwise? So they would have been put in the oven and somebody else would have been put in their place.
But they were, not to trivialize anything, but they were already dead. Do you know, I'm trying to understand the guilt in terms of they didn't kill the people.
So this is exactly what you'll read, is the complexity of it, of how different people approached it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also want to say that all of us that give tours tell a story. And if it weren't for Sonderkommando, Fritzy would not be with us. And if it weren't for Sonderkommando, Izzy Stark would not be with us. My cousin would not be with us. Every single, Elie Wiesel would not be with us. Because they're the ones that came on to the trains that said, lie about your age, give the babies to the mothers. These were the workers in the striped uniform. So a lot of them, because they knew what was coming,
I'm not sure how many of those actually were at the trains, but to Mickey's point, so for example, they talk about how there were dilemma about informing people or not informing people.
Some
people informed and they wanted to know, and some people felt, but it was an ongoing challenge. So I don't think it's, I think there, it's a multi-layered complex issue here. You know, the question of the guilt versus the accessory, I think it's very difficult for anybody to even consider that these people would couldn't consider them accessories to murder in any fashion.
But
yeah.
The campus, the ones who were by the train, et cetera, et cetera. The Sonder commandos were only inside the gas chamber, the crematorium, et cetera.
So I'm not sure. I don't know enough to know if any of the Sonder commando ever met any of these people at the trains. I can't say I don't know enough about that. I do know that there is a lot of discussion about the people who were led into the bunker, what they called, and how those conversations were. Some of the people they described knew what they were going to. Some of them did not know. Some of them were asking. So some of the Sonder commando told, and some of them didn't tell, because they're different. You know, that's part of the horror. Yeah, what were we going to add?
This question came up between myself and my mentee about a year ago. We wanted to really quantify the Sonder commando and where they were. And they were not part of the selection. They never wore uniforms. They were in their own clothes. They were in the death part, as you're describing. So it's not, they were not the selection people by the trainers. And it was Kelly who we actually defined and quantified our question.
Great.
So that actually
to that point, also, one of the unique and sick, crazy, bizarre realities is that the Sonder commando were treated differently than everyone else in many respects. They had regular barracks. They had mattresses. They slept on mattresses, which is, by the way, we'll get to in a little bit. On October 7th, 1944, there was an uprising in the crematoria. They burned down crematoria 2, not with gunpowder. They actually lit several mattresses on fire. And that was how they started to burn down the crematoria. They had access to regular food, like the camp, but they also had, through the people that they encountered, they had also access to extra food, or Canada people who were able to organize food for them. And this goes back to something somebody else was alluding to in terms of how they were able to smuggle things to others that they were able to pick off. You know, of course, they were also responsible to going through the bodies afterwards and picking out gold teeth and searching bodily openings for hidden valuables they were forced to do. So it's a...
Were they always Jewish? Did they ever have non-Jews?
So I don't know. I don't know. I don't recall if they ever had non-Jews. I'm not sure with certainty. I don't know. I would have to go back and double check. So what we want to focus on today for this discussion is the spiritual life, the religious resistance of Sonder commando. And what does that mean, or what does that look like? Because if we have talked about spiritual resistance and religious life in a ghetto or in a forest or in a work camp, now we're at a totally different place. And to do that, we're going to focus on one person. This man was born around 1910 in Warsaw, and his name was Reb Leib Langfuss. Langfuss.
Okay, spell.
Leib Langfuss. So it's in your packet. We're going to get to it in the Scrolls of Auschwitz packet. Yeah. Yes. No. This was afterwards in Israel.
Yes, for several years.
Okay, so it was after he was done in Israel.
Yeah, I forget, the last 20 years. Yes, he tracked down.
Okay.
So this man, Reb Leib Langfuss, is born in 1910 in Warsaw, and he studies in a yeshiva called in a town called Suzmir. And in 1933 or 1934, he marries a girl named Dvori, which is Yiddishized for Dvorah. Dvori was his wife. She was the daughter of Rav Shmuel Yosef Rosenthal, the Dayan of Makov. What is a Dayan? A Dayan, right? A judge. The religious judge. It means different than the Rav, than the rabbi of the city. He was the Dayan. It means he was the arbiter of religious disputes. So he's not going to play a pastoral role, this Rav Shmuel Yosef Rosenthal. He's playing more of a juridical role. He passes away a short time later, and he is succeeded by his son-in-law, Rav Leib Langfuss. This Rabbi Leib Langfuss is now serving as the Dayan, as the religious arbiter in Makov. In November, December 1942, the Germans roll in. They round up all the Jews of Makov and they ship them off to Auschwitz. When they arrive there, within a day or two, Reb Leib Langfuss's wife, Dvorah, and their son, whose name was Shmuel, named after her father, were killed right away. They were killed in Auschwitz upon arrival. But he, Reb Leib Langfuss, is sent to work in the Sonderkommando. The last recorded information we have about Reb Leib Langfuss is on the 26th of November, 1944, which means he works in the Sonderkommando for approximately 2 years. 2 years in the Sonderkommando. How do we have information about Reb Leib Langfuss in 1944? Because he kept written records. There were members of the Sonderkommando who were committed to documenting what they experienced so that it should be known. And what did they do with their documents, which, by the way, you can imagine how difficult it was to get paper, even to organize paper. They buried it in various areas near the crematoria, which is where they were. So over the course of several years, from the 1940s into the 1960s, excavations took place at Auschwitz where they unearthed various documents and artifacts. We're focused on religious resistance. What is one of the artifacts that was buried near the crematoria that was meant to demonstrate what Jewish life represents and is what it's all about? A pair of tefillin. A pair of tefillin that someone should come and find it one day. And in addition, there were writings of different groups of people, and that is the Scrolls of Auschwitz. The Scrolls of Auschwitz is a collection of several of these documents that were buried near the crematoria, written by the Sonderkommando. So Bear Mark went through and detailed the content of each of these. They were originally written in what language would you guess? That's right, they were written in Yiddish. And they were buried, and he identifies whose they are. Some of these manuscripts are anonymous, but through some smart detective work of this smart woman, Esther Mark, she figures out how to put two and two together. One of the documents is signed A-L-R-A. A-L-R-A. Who is A-L-R-A? Well, it might be a code. What is Langfuss in Yiddish? Right.
What?
Say it louder. They can.
Long foot.
Lang is long. Fies is foot. Long foot. So translated in Yiddish, long foot would be in Hebrew. What would it be in Hebrew? Regel Aroch.
Yeah.
What is Leib in Yiddish or in Hebrew? Aryeh Leib. That's why.
Lion of heart.
Aryeh Leib. That's why. Exactly. The heart of a lion. That's a traditional name, Yiddish name, Ari Leib. How did Eliezer Ben Yehuda get his name Ben Yehuda? Because his father's name was Leib. So when he went to Hebraicize his name, my father's name is Leib. In Hebrew, in the Gemara, in Chumash, Leib, lion, and Yehuda, Gur Aryeh Yehuda, that's why those two are together. So Eliezer Ben Yehuda got his name Ben Yehuda because his father's name was Leib. Aryeh is a lion. Aryeh Leib. He signed his name with a code. A-L-R-A is Aryeh Leib Regel Aroch. Aleph Lamed Reish Aleph. And that is how Esther Mark cracked the code. And she said that was his way of signaling who the author was. Langfus in Hebrew is Reish Aleph, Regel Aroch. Genius. Smart woman, huh? So she puts together some of the pieces of paper here, which are not documented, and she puts them together. At the time when he was in the Sonder Commando, there were, give or take, about 600 plus members of the Sonder Commando who were working in the crematoria in Auschwitz. By this time, at the end of 1944, the deportations had slowed considerably because, unfortunately, the masses of Hungarian Jews had already been murdered by the Germans, you know, over the late summer of 1944. So now things are slowing down, and the underground is becoming more and more active, more and more concerned. They know that the war is turning. They know that the Russians are eventually going to come for them, but they also know that the work is slowing down, and that's a bad omen for them. So there were two areas, and this is actually a big focus of the School of Auschwitz, is about the underground, the resistance. There were two areas where there was resistance in Auschwitz, and then separate the Sonderkommando. And initially, they had been in communication with each other about a joint uprising. But for various reasons, the joint uprising didn't materialize. So on October 7th, there was an uprising, but it was only an uprising in the Birkenau crematoria, not in Auschwitz I, not in the other camp. And that was the uprising of the Sonderkommando. They burned one of the crematoria. They started running in all directions. Of course, the Germans immediately mowed them down and hunted them down. And after 2 days, there was a grand total of 200 members of the Sonderkommando, which means that 400 had been murdered over the course of the uprising. And some questions remained afterwards. Did people feel that it was worthwhile? Was it not worthwhile? That's a separate conversation. There was some discussion. Maybe Rav Leib Langfuss died. He did not. We have this journal entry as part of the publication from 26th of November 1944. That's the last entry that we have. And after that, it's silent. Zigazunt. He was likely murdered shortly thereafter. He gives us several documents. So you'll see in your packets, he has documents about, I guess we can categorize them in three ways. One is about deportations. He reflects what it was like being deported from Makov. The second one are two lengthy and gruesome descriptions of Jews being led into the bunker, into the gas chamber. He talks about 600 kids, young people, and then he talks about 3,000 women. Each of these episodes you can read. It's in the English translation that you have there from Baer. They're very, very intense. They're heartbreaking and horrible. The description, it's horrible. And then he has a third document, which is different from these two, in that it is a list. It's just what he calls particulars, details. So he gives you a list of the names of the places and how many people they had gone through. This is an unusual set of circumstances. You have a man who before the war serves as a rabbi and a dayan, and now spends almost 2 years as a Sonderkommando. So how does religious life fit into this paradox? So in one place, In the book on the bottom on this page, which you don't have in front of you, it's the Matters of Testimony book. They have an English translation of the selection of his reflection of the speech that he, Reb Leib Langfuss, gave to the other Jews in Makov when they were taken away. And one of the things that he tells them is Mergein Allah Afkidish Hashem, which means we are all going to sanctify the name of God. What does that mean? He says, we all know that we're going to be martyrs. And so he's framing it in a religious context, in the act of Mesiras Nefesh, of giving up your soul for Hashem, similar to the Akedah, a person sacrificing their life for God, which is consistent with the martyrdom that we find throughout Jewish history. One of the things that you hear in the reports of the Sonder Commando when they were asked, one of them was asked, did you hear from the inside?
Could you hear inside the room with the prisoners?
Right. Okay. So they said some of the people you heard calling the names of family members, and some of them you heard saying Shema Yisrael. They have one report of someone, one of the Sonder Commando, who was asked by a Jew who was being brought down, is this the end? He says, you have to tell me, is this the end? Because if it's the end, I want to say Vidui. The confession that a person says before they leave this world. And they said, yes, it is. So they said the vidui together. Another one brought a l'chaim. And he says that you, the two Jews who were making a l'chaim in the undressing area, said to the Sonder Commando, he says, you're going to live and tell them that we died. That the Jewish people died, but that we will survive. It's like unbelievable stories. Unbelievable. You can't even give words to them. So the idea of Kiddush Hashem and how that connects to these Sonder Commando is very intertwined. The experiences that they saw of Jews going to their death and still clinging to that sanctification of God's name. So that's where he begins at the deportations with the orientation towards sanctification of God's name. But another interesting element is that when he got to the Sonder Commando, the other workers treated him differently. One of the Sonder Commando in Gideon Greif's book reports, and it's also, he alludes to this in his writings, that because he was a Rav, they didn't let him deal directly with the bodies. And that he was never responsible to put the Jews into the room.
In the museum, in one of the videos, it talks about there was a rabbi, they make reference to a rabbi who one day said Kaddish over all of these bodies. Does anybody know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Where was that?
It's right when you pass the model of the crematorium.
Well, I'm saying, where are they saying that? Where did that episode happen?
Is it in the Benchik area?
No, not in the back.
Where does that episode take place historically?
Historically?
What does it say? Because you can imagine, you know, there are so...
It was included in an area where they also talked about uprisings. The video is the resistance thing.
Yeah, but I don't know where...
So it must be,
but you're asking where...
Yeah, I don't know, because I can imagine that there are many... Such examples.
It's probably across from where
the bra, with the bra and the belt are.
So there's a very extended also about lighting candles.
Yes.
So I don't know about that specific episode, but in this series you'll find a lot of examples of things like that.
So in our Belgium area, the testimony of the Sonder Commando, and they also talk about being in the barracks at night saying Kaddish for the people that passed.
Right, so we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. But I thought it was very interesting that one of the debates around the Sonder Commando is, did they lose their humanity? And so they themselves, in many of these descriptions in Greif's book, say how they were robots, they weren't people. But at the same time, the fact that there was this recognition that there was a rabbi, and that rabbi was different, or that there were friends. So one of the Sonder Commando describes how one of the other guys, and we'll read it in a second, was looking out for him and was taking care of him. And so on the one hand, they had to do the most inhuman task. But on the other hand, there is an element of resistance, of humanity, that they could still experience, that they could still create within their framework. Yeah, Cecilia.
Just the fact that they did it in order to be alive, isn't that some way of resistance?
Yeah, for sure. We're going to get to that more directly in a second with Rabbi Langfuss in a minute. Well, the whole that, I want to get to one thing before that. Two of the, yeah.
You're expressing also that there still was trying to, the maintenance of the moral code.
Yes, that.
The threat of the moral code.
Yes, that this person is a rabbi. Yeah. Yes, and that, I don't know if any of these other people were even religious people. I suspect that most of them were not. Mm-hmm. But that they organized it, that his job was dragging corpses but not putting them in the oven.
So many things touch your heart, but that's...
Right, like such a... Isn't that an interesting thing that, at least to me, such a small detail, but it speaks about a kind of experience. The fact that it describes that he didn't put in the oven, Lola, you can't even speak such things, but he was dragging but not putting in the oven. Or they said that when he was on the other end, they would have him cleaning the room and not... So that itself is...
But the question is that when you're saying they, you're referring to the other
Sandu Commander members,
so
yes.
How did the Nazis or the whoever's in charge of them, you know, allow that to
so obviously one of the things that happens in the camp all over the place is this kind of under their nose, sub, right, exactly. So people wouldn't necessarily notice who's being, that's one of the things they allude to, that it was done very discreetly, that it happens to be that he was put in charge of cleaning this area when something else was happening. But who would even think of that? Who would even be sensitive to that? But yet, people were sensitive to that, which is amazing. And now we can talk about some of the experiences that was there. So one of the, there was a survivor's name was Eliezer Eisenschmidt, who was interviewed by Greif. And he describes that they had a Pesach Seder in the Sonderkommando barracks in 1944. Because they had flour, and they had water, and they had an oven. If you could even imagine such a thing. So they figured out they would make some matzahs. And the problem was, they said, this is in, if you're looking at it, if you want to check it out in the Greif book, it's on page, you don't have it in front of you, it's on page 247. It says, well, they asked Rabbi Langfuss, how are they going to have Kiddush? He says, we're going to say Kiddush on the tea that we have. They didn't have wine for four cups, they didn't have grape juice, but they had tea. So that was their Kiddush. There was a Greek survivor, a Sonderkommando, name is Yaakov Gabay, who describes that in 1944, it's on page 200, it's not in the packet, it's in the Greif book, that they had a Kol Nidre davening. That the Germans gave them off Erev Yom Kippur. The next day they said there were 2,000 arrivals. That was the Germans, that's what the survivor says, was Germans' Yom Kippur present for them. 2,000 Jews. But the night before,
the Germans gave them
on Erev Yom Kippur, they had no work on Erev Yom Kippur 1944, and a group of Polish Sonderkommando, they organized benches and a Kol Nidre service. That's what he says. And who's there? They have a Rav, so to speak. They have a rabbi. They have Rav Leib Langfuss. You talk, right? It's like, and what's amazing is that we know that there are stories that are around with these kinds of things which are spurious. They are made up and they can't be true. But these are probably, they're very likely to be true, because the Sonderkommando actually had more access to like food items and other valuables, time and a more normal type of living conditions that these things are possible. So when you have someone who remembers this vividly, that's their recollection. It's amazing. to think about that. And then you put this in your pocket with all of your other stories of things that are going on contemporaneously, of how it was that same year. We go back many months to the discussion that we once had with the story of Reb Hirsch Meisel's, the Weizener Rav, with the shofar and a group of boys in a barrack. It's the same time, just in a different part of the camp. No, that was many more. That was like 1,000+. Different part of the camp, yeah. Different thing. It may have been the same boys, but it was a different part of the camp. Then you have the same, at the same time, I don't remember if it was exactly the same time, but we talked about a group, this girl in the laundromat who's keeping a Jewish calendar. Like, mm-hmm. You think about how these things are happening distinct from each other, but all across the same slice of time. And how the girl in the laundromat who's keeping a Jewish calendar would never know that in the Sanda commander they're keeping Yom Kippur, right? They're having Kol Nidre service. And it's really unbelievable. So when we talk about religious life and spiritual resistance, it's just, this is indescribable. So now we talk about faith. And this is incredibly intense. This is the back, this is Yankel Zilberberg. I called him Yankel because in the book it's Yaakov, but his original name was Yankel. That's what he tells you. His name was Yankel. And Gideon Greif writes that many times during this interview, I think it was with him, he kept saying, this is on the back side of the page that says, "We wept without tears." This man kept saying, what's that?
The light print.
Yeah, the light print. He kept saying, if there were enough pens in the world and enough ink, you could never write what I saw. That was his refrain, over and over. You could never write what I saw. So he starts, this Yankel Zilberberg talks about his friend who was helping him, had been there before, just getting him acclimated. So Shlomo Kirschenbaum told me that the Dayan from Makov was at one of the large crematorium and that I ought to speak with him. Why does he want to speak with the Dayan? Elsewhere in the book is referred to as the Magid. What is a Magid? A Magid is a preacher. He was not a preacher. He was a Dayan. He was a judge. Well, this Yankel Zilberberg was from an ultra-Orthodox religious home, and he was a Kohen. And
how do you deal
with that? Right. A Kohen is restricted from... Exactly. You know, that's one of the interesting facets of the life of a Kohen is how do you navigate that today. So I've only been to maybe one or two cemeteries, but they in Israel, they have a very smart thing, Jewish country. So they put the portion of the Kohanim at the edge of the cemetery. So my paternal grandfather, who lived in Israel for many years, he's buried at the edge of a cemetery. So I can go to the edge of the cemetery and I can see his grave just over the fence.
Shalom does
this. Oh, yeah?
Or at least they used to. Because I know that my grandfather is buried. Also.
But the edge of the cemetery.
Yeah.
At least as I recall from where I live, it was used for people who were not kind of.
Oh, good. So, right. Society. So sometimes they have different sections of the cemetery for different groups, yes. But in Israel, the front is actually usually used for Kohanim. That's why I've been to very few funerals. But now here, if you look closely, this is just a Ripley's Believe It or Not. If you look at the Chicago Jewish Funerals building on what Gross Point, Skokie Boulevard. So if you look at the building facing north, there's a little building on the right side, and then there's the main building on the left side. So the main building, that's where the mace, that's where the deceased person goes. We, the Kohanim, we have a special box. And if you look carefully at the top, there is no connection between the buildings. There's a little break in the roof between where we sit and where the funeral takes place. So, yes. So that way, if I go to his funeral, I sit in the box. They have a screen. We can see. We can hear. Right? Should know from such things. We could speak, has been the case. So
it's part of the experience of being a Kohen. It only applies to male Kohanim. So when Necham and I went to my grandfather's grave, so she went on to put a stone. But what do you do if you're a Kohen and your name is Yankel Zilberberg and you're sent to this place, which is the epicenter of death? So he says, I went to the Dayan and I asked his advice. So look at what Gidon, the italicized section here is Gidon Greif, the interviewer. He says, so you felt it was important to receive an answer for rabbinical authority? Right? What does that tell us?
Religious aspects.
They still cared.
Yeah.
This little Yidel still had his connection to the Rabbono Shel Olam, to God. Even in this hell, the seventh level. Yes, said Yankel. I also asked him lots of other questions about these matters. Had you known the Dayan previously? Was he famous? Definitely. What did he tell you? He said, don't worry. We are here to do God's mission. God wants it this way. And we have to take his action because it's a mitzvah. It's the Creator's will. It's not within our power to change his will, just as we can have no control in his decisions. He also told me that, in his opinion, what we were doing was a mitzvah because in this manner the Jews were given some sort form of burial. That's what I said at the beginning. You have to stay at a distance here. Were you satisfied with his explanation? So Yankel says, I must have been satisfied at the time. A person tends to trust someone who is greater than him, who is authoritative, who can understand, and who can tell good from evil. Now, what he's going to write now is going to what he's going to tell you now is hair raising. And if it was not being recorded in this way from this person in this place, you would never accept it. You would scream at such a person. What else did you ask the Dayan? I asked him, what about the little children who are being murdered here? What are they guilty of? They don't know a thing. They've barely even taken a breath. The Dayan told me the children have sinned too. Little children, even the newborns, are tainted from their mother's milk. They've inherited their mother's sins. So Greif asks him, did the rabbi, the Dayan, really say that? That little children who had hardly had a chance to breathe were tainted with sin and therefore doomed to die, to be murdered? Yes. Now look what he writes, which is very interesting. It steered me to the decision I had to make, to live, to be at peace with myself, and to speak with the other survivors and tell them how much suffering a person must endure to be worthy of life. When you came away from the rabbi, had you decided to accept his approach? I was still devout back then. I wanted to live. Where did this conversation take place? In the crematorium.
So it was a way to make it feel
at peace.
Better.
Feel better, a lens
in which they could cope. I don't know.
I'm confused. Okay, so bear with me. Is it a Jewish thing to say that you're like tainted at birth?
No.
Doesn't that sound Christian? So, okay. So
good. So do we all, and this is. It's a question. What did he mean by this? There is a Talmudic principle that children inherit their parents' sins. So the Talmud says, what are you talking about? It says in the Chumash, it says in the Bible, that children don't inherit their parents' sins. No such thing. So the Talmud says, you know when they inherit their parents' sins? When they, what's called, Ochzim Maise Avoseim Biyadeim. When they follow in the parents' evil ways, so then they also carry on their parents' legacy. If your you know, if you are a gangster and your grandfather was a gangster, your father, it's your family business to be gangsters. So then you get to carry on the family legacy of Averus. But other than that, the Gemara says, there's no such thing as carrying on somebody else's sins. No such thing.
But it's also saying that this is happening to the Jews because they sinned?
That's right.
Further question.
Yeah.
Wait a second. What could justify this kind of destruction? And many of us have heard arguments like this mm-hmm. in various corners of various communities.
Oh, absolutely.
And I will tell you what's interesting. I'll take a step back. A couple of years ago, I was invited from one of the local day schools. And I was speaking with a group of 8th grade students. And I presented them various approaches to emunah, to connecting with God after the Holocaust. So one of the approaches in Judaism is called schar va'onesh, reward and punishment. That there is something, that God has a calculus, he is accounting for everything for everybody. So I asked the kids, and maybe it's because they're children, I asked the kids, how many of you think that schar va'onesh, reward and punishment, can account for the Holocaust? And I actually had like 2 kids who said yes.
That's
which was surprising to me. It was very surprising to me.
More than that.
Probably because they, I don't know if they really understood what that meant. But that's a very difficult explanation for the Holocaust. It's interesting. If you look at the writings of a man who we've spoken about extensively, Rav Clonimus Kalman Shapira, the Piasetzner Rebbe, the Rebbe from the Warsaw Ghetto, and you look at the development of his religious thought in the sermons that he gave, you notice a trend. This is documented by Nehemiah Pohl in his book Holy Fire. And I've had the privilege of studying these sermons that he was giving in the ghetto, that at the beginning of the war, the theme of reward and punishment is very prevalent. He's talking to the Jews about tshuva and what we did and what we could do and what we should do. But over 1942, all of a sudden that theme moves away. It disappears. Because how can sin and punishment account for what they're experiencing? It's incomprehensible. It's inconceivable. So there must be something else. He talks about it in a different context of suffering. He harkens back to Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, the famous Jewish martyr who was tortured to death by the Romans. And some kind of transcendent spiritual experience that cannot be explained by sin at all. Right? That's exactly what you're pointing out.
Yeah.
So as a reader of this passage, I'm left with a question mark. What did Reb Leib Langfuss mean? Is this what he thought? Was this a coping mechanism? Because it's interesting that the way that this little Yidel took it was actually as a coping mechanism. That he's like, okay, at least that's some way to, right?
To accept.
Right. If Reb Leib Langfuss, Hashem Yikom Domo, if he survived the war 15 years later, would he say the same thing? I don't know. It's a mystery. But to me, while that mystery remains, which, and I don't have any answer for that, because, you know, if any of us were ever to present Jewish, religious, Orthodox, Torah perspectives on the Holocaust, and we tried to suggest this, I would walk out on your lecture. I'm just telling you. If you were giving the tour and I were there, I would walk out.
Yeah.
I wouldn't walk out on your tour in general. I'd be happy to come on your tour. Just kidding.
but it's
very disturbing, right?
But I'm just thinking, because he embraces this because otherwise God is guilty?
Right? That's the... Right?
Yeah. It's the choice.
Right.
No.
So it's hard to know what... What did he mean, and why was he saying this, and would he agree with it now? And think about what the context was. A guy comes to you in a crematorium, there are, and says, How do I justify this?
Mm. It's also the way he heard it. It's not, maybe not necessarily, we don't know that.
Right, this goes back to the oral history question.
Right.
But that was his, but that's what he's saying.
This was written down.
No, no, this is his personal recollection. It's interesting. And Reb Leib Langfuss, in the documents that we have, does not address this question. He does not address the religious dimension very much at all. That note about the Kiddush Hashem. But it's so interesting. So to me, this piece of it, I wanted you to have it in print because it's shocking. It makes you shake. But to take a step back is to contextualize it and to take away a message, which is God was still alive for them in the crematorium. And even though this little Yidel Yankel Zilberberg leaves the gas chambers and comes to Israel and says that he's not religious anymore, that's what he says, he's not religious anymore, but his line is, he's lost his faith, but not his religion.
What?
I don't know what that means. And at the end of the book, the last section of the book is about him thanking God for the things that he has in his rebuilt life.
So he does believe.
He's confused.
Well, he's conflicted. He's struggling. And isn't that the way oftentimes we feel in our relationship with God in the context of this building? That we have a God and we believe in God and we know that God is just. And yet we are staring at a question that has no answer. And so what this shows is, number one, that people were still interested, even the Sonder Commander, even in the death camp, in the heart of the death, they were still interested in seeking. Again, not everybody, but these two individuals. And they were looking for some way to put it together.
Makes sense.
How do we know that the Rav wasn't conflicted in giving his answer?
Exactly.
And the way that he was hearing it.
That's what Mickey was saying. Exactly. We don't.
The thought is conflict, and then putting it in these words.
Right. We have no idea. This right. is an oral history that's given decades later. And he didn't write about it, so we don't know what's happening. So my goal is that in walking away from this session, we're not going to have answers to this piece because it's a mystery. He was murdered, and we don't know what he was thinking deep down. And we don't know, at least I, could never even begin to accept for myself as a spiritual seeker, I could never accept this answer from anyone. But at the same time, the conversation and the struggle and the search, that to me speaks of spiritual resistance and trying to come up with some framework, some way of, like he says himself, Zilberberg, it steered me to the decision to live. And that moment, that worked. I, today in 2019, that would never work. Not for me, and not for, I shouldn't say it would never work. There are people out there who think that it works. But I, who believe in a loving, caring God who pays attention to all of us, who wants us to succeed, who wants to see goodness and light and love, can't explain that.
But one question that I have is,
yeah, then we'll get to,
if this was written or told much later, is it really what he thought or felt then?
Okay, so this, exactly. So this is the exact thing that Ina was getting to. Well, it's partly to what Ina and Mickey were getting to in terms of, is this his interpretation of what Rabbi Langfuss said to him? Is it his memory? Is it something that he would accept today? The answer is, we know that this is what he remembers that he heard at the time, and it worked for him at the time. No, I don't think that Yaakov Zilberberg would subscribe to that today. Surely not. Nor would anybody else that I know. But it's such a powerful demonstration of people's commitment to finding some way to keep going with God.
Right.
To keep going with God. Exactly. It's a coping mechanism within a religious framework. That to me is what we would call in Hebrew the chiddush, the novel thing that I took from this, is that people, religious people, were looking for spiritual coping mechanisms, even if afterwards they said we're not religious, but they still come back to God. Right? For so many people, that's an important part of this narrative. And that's the purpose, really, and this will be my summary note for this year. That's really the purpose of this journey that we're on every year, is to unearth a spiritual and religious dimension of people's lives in the Holocaust, and how we see that this was a living experience in every corner. That is the takeaway for me. And if we go back over the course of the last several months, if we think about the different episodes that we can draw upon to realize the great spiritual metal of so many of these simple, plain Jews, it's incredibly, incredibly inspiring. Yeah, sure.
My late sister married into a very large kahuna family.
Okay.
In St. Louis. My brother-in-law has 52 first cousins. That's how big the family is. The family is huge. And the quantity...